Facing pressure, Orleans County Senator Samuel Douglas officially resigns. Plus, the UVM Health Network aims for a course correction, and a Texas company eyes the former Vermont Yankee site. All that and more ahead on Vermont This Week.
From the Vermont Public Studio in Winooski, this is Vermont This Week. Made possible in part by the Lintelac Foundation and Milne Travel. Here's moderator Mitch Wertlieb.
Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. It's Friday, October 24th. And with us on the panel today, we have Kevin McCallum from 7 Days, Olivia Giger from VT Digger, and joining us remotely today, Howard Weist-Hisman from Vermont Public. Thank you all so much for being here. We're going to start with a story that we have been talking about for a couple of weeks now. And Kevin McCallum, this is about Sam Douglas, who got himself into some pretty hot water, taking part in a racist, misogynist, anti-Semitic text group chat. He has now officially resigned. There was a little bit of confusion at first over whether he had technically done so. And now there's a new candidate who said he wants to take that seat, but let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. What do we know about Douglas's resignation and what's going to happen next?
Right. So there was some question immediately after the publication of these stories about the text messages that he had been involved in about whether and when he might resign. So there were several days when everyone was kind of wondering and speculating about, is he going to, isn't he going to, what does this statement mean? And he had said, I'll have a statement for everybody by the end of the week. And so, but he didn't immediately resign. And so it really raised a lot of questions for people about, well, is he going to dig in? Is he going to make them remove him from his Senate seat? And under intense pressure from several prominent Republican officials in the state, including Governor Scott, right? He made the decision to step aside. And he basically, it was interesting though, because he made the decision less because he was taking responsibility for the things that he said and more because he was saying essentially that he was in danger, that he has a young child, and that there were all these comments that were made about him and to him that were vile. And so he kind of turned this story around a little. That was about vile comments made by young Republicans around the country, and he kind of made it about the vile comments that people were saying about him as the reason that he resigned, which I found interesting. And so there was a little confusion about when, in fact, he would be stepping down. That got resolved.
And I think part of that confusion, Kevin, I could just interrupt for a moment, is because Paul Dame, the chairman of the Republican Party, was one of the outliers who did not call for his resignation, saying that, you know, he should apologize for this, he should address the comments, but he didn't think he should step down. That had me wondering, is he starting, as you were implying, maybe he's thinking this over instead, but that was not the case.
That's exactly right. For a while there, people were going, if this is what the chair of the Republican Party is saying he should do, which is apologize and move on, then maybe he's going to take that advice to heart, and maybe that's exactly what he's going to try to do. Turns out, not the case. The pressures were too great. And so he did step aside, and of course, what happened immediately was that Democrats saw the opportunity to make sure that they told the world that they have a candidate that they think would be a better fit for Senate in the state of Vermont. He's from Troy. He's a select board member. He's a retired Army general. His name is Gaston Bathelon. We don't know much about him, right? He hasn't been in statewide politics, but he did a pretty good job of getting out a press release to the world and a picture of himself, letting everybody know that he was going to try to restore public integrity to the institution. And it was probably a good move on the Democrats to put that marker down now, because Governor Scott is almost certain to be appointing a Republican to replace Sam. And so the Democrats wanted to plant that seed for everybody to say, just because there's a Republican who's going to be replacing him doesn't mean that that's the end of the story.
Yeah, and it's pretty important now for Democrats because, as we know, in the last election, there was that red wave that really took away their supermajority. So now these seats become more critical when you're talking about these things politically. I find it really interesting what you mentioned there, Kevin, about Sam Douglas saying, you know, he was receiving threats. He got some vitriol directed at him. You know, I suppose we have to take him at his word for that. But this brings us to a story, Howard Weist-Hisman, that you reported on recently. And it has to do with, you know, sort of the poison political environment throughout the entire country right now. But we're not immune to it here in Vermont. What were you seeing happening? What are some of the things that you saw in some of the smaller places here in Vermont?
Yeah. So this is one of those stories that just kind of kept building on itself. The original news story was that the town of Stratford, which is a very small town in the Upper Valley, the town clerk there was threatened by someone in town. There's a long story behind that I won't get into, but they had to lock their town office door and only make the office open by appointment. So I thought that was interesting. I started calling around. I found out that the town of Mendon dealt with a similar situation. I was hearing from other town clerks. I talked to someone up in Aalborg who was saying that they had people at their select board meetings. So as you said, it really falls into this whole narrative of our country. We're all have our heels dug in. We're all yelling at each other. We're not listening to each other enough. And it really is playing out in these small towns. And the big challenge, of course, is that our participatory democracy is all about showing up. We have our small select board meetings. We have our town meeting. It's all about going down to the town office, hashing out our differences, and then ideally moving along together. But that's happening less and less. And I spoke to Ted Brady at the Vermont League of Cities and Towns. They just held their annual meeting, and they actually brought in a national expert on this who was talking about the same thing. This is a national problem. Obviously, we're hearing a lot about it, and unfortunately, it's showing up more here in Vermont. It's very unsettling. And really, it comes down to it's not this side or the other side. We're all, I think, we all need to listen to each other and see our similarities, listen to the other side, and try to move forward together. That's ideally.
I feel like that's a really important point, Howard, because, you know, again, if Sam Douglas is to be believed, you know, he was receiving a lot of vitriol towards his family. He felt that was part of the reason he had to step down. So this is not something where it's just people on the right who make threats. It could be people on the left. The point is, it's people that are overstepping their bounds. And this is a bad kind of new normal, if that's what it is. Is that what people were telling you?
It is. And a lot of people, we didn't lean into this too much in the story, but a lot of people did talk about the message that is coming down from the top from President Trump, questioning the integrity of elections, talking about the Patriots who stormed the Capitol on January 6th, and that whole idea that it's okay to show your anger, it's okay to yell at people. People down here are trying to say that it's not okay, that we need to tone everything down and try to work together more.
All right. Well, thank you for the update on that, Howard, as sad as the story is. And, you know, this transitions into something as we're talking about President Trump. We're talking about the relationship between the feds and states throughout the country. And Kevin McCallum, you've been writing about this really sort of amazing story here that's affecting Governor Phil Scott. You know, back in August, he willingly gave information to the federal government for people receiving SNAP benefits here in Vermont. About 140,000 Vermonters' sensitive personal information was given. At the time, the Attorney General, Charity Clark, did not want the governor to do this. He went ahead and did it anyway. What did a federal judge recently say about Scott's move there?
Right. So this case did move forward with, I think, 22 other states suing the federal government to block the data from being demanded by the federal government, by the USDA. And even though Vermont was not part of the state of the lawsuit, the lawsuit went forward and it made some significant progress earlier this week or last week. I can't quite remember. But a judge there basically said, look, the federal government may have a right to some of this data and it may be able to prove that down the road. But at the moment where we stand now, it looks as though the states are going to prevail in their argument that they did not do it properly. Like, there is a way to go about getting the data from the states that the states have about the federal program. And they just don't appear to have done it properly. So she imposed what's called a preliminary injunction, which basically makes it for the moment while the case proceeds that the states do not have to comply with the USDA's order. So what that means is that Phil Scott made a decision on his own back in August about this being something that he was going to follow the request by the federal government. And that request may, in fact, have been illegal. And so Democrats have just been fierce in pouncing on this development. They were pretty sharp about it a couple months ago, but now that the judge has essentially temporarily ruled that it looks as though this may have been illegal. Democrats have been pretty tough.
One in particular, the state treasurer of Vermont.
The state treasurer is Mike Pichek, is seen by many people as the most likely gubernatorial challenger to Phil Scott next year. And he said something to me just the other day where he said, this is an example of how when Governor Scott doesn't fight, Vermonters lose. And that was kind of rough. I mean, he's a pretty mild mannered guy, and so for him to say that, the Democratic Party was even rougher. I'm going to have to make sure I get this one accurate. They said the Trump administration is driving a dangerous mass surveillance effort, and Phil Scott's cooperation has made Vermont part of it. I mean, so that's always been the problem with this issue about sharing the data. Was like, well, what's the problem with sharing the data? Right, the people get the benefits. We know what they're. Names and addresses and social security numbers are. What's the problem with sharing that with the federal government? And the critics have said, you don't know what they're going to do with that information. You don't know what they're going to do with a massive database of people. Like you said, 140,000 people. What are they going to comb through that data looking for? So that's where the real difference of opinion here lies is the intent. If you assume ill intent on the part of the federal government, you might want to fight and block this information from being shared. If you think it's the federal government's data to begin with, and we don't have a right to stop them from having it, then you might give it to them. So very different opinions on this, on a potent subject.
All right. Thank you for updating us on that particular story. Olivia Giger, I want to turn to you now because you had a really fascinating story about something happening with the UVM Health Network, largest health network, of course, in the state of Vermont. And this has to do with some course correction as far as saving money. And we're hearing about layoffs at UVM Health Network. When I hear about layoffs, I immediately think, oh, it's got to be workers. Not the case here. Who's being laid off? Why is this happening?
Not the case here. What we're seeing at UVM is these top executives are leaving. And it's, as you said, kind of a course correction to what we saw this summer, late kind of September, with the Green Mountain Care Board decisions, where they were really adamant that the really high cost of executive compensation to this hospital network is what's driving a lot of the high costs at UVM Medical Center and its affiliates in the UVM Health Network. So one of the big things we're seeing is as Steve Loeffler, the new CEO of the health network, takes his new position at the helm of UVM, this was the first Monday of his time here, he's kind of laying down a new direction for the health network. And really what that's looking like is something that's much more focused on the hospital level. He's shifting the power back to having hospital presidents report to him instead of report to some of these kind of middle level execs at the network. He's something that I think is actually really interesting that's a little wonky is that he has also, as part of that decision to make these layoffs, he's shifted some governance structure so that the chairs of the affiliate hospital board of trustees now have voting positions on the network board, which I think is all part of this vision that he's voiced to say, I mean, the hospital network really got a lot of scrutiny during those care board decisions and all of the conversations surrounding it. We saw even Phil Scott in this kind of unusual press release he released surrounding the care board decisions. He specifically called out just the high executive compensation, which I think really hit home there. The other line that just rings in my ears from the care board conversations was the board chair, Owen Foster, called these executives at the network level physically and spiritually distant, which
is pretty strong wording
sure. That I think has really hit home. And we see now the network is responding. Sunny Eben, the former CEO and president of the network, stepped down. Steve Loeffler is taking hold. He's coming from UVM Medical Center. He's this ER doc. He's focused on the hospitals. And that really is the vision it sounds like he's trying to to push forward is this much more network-light version.
Yeah, and the Green Mountain Care Board must be happy with this movement. It's something different than we've seen usually. You were also reporting on another thing that's driving a lot of the rising healthcare mm-hmm. costs, and this is the effect of state-level lobbying that's going on. Who did you speak with about that? We may have spoken to the same person, I suspect, on this, because I found this really fascinating, a UVM professor. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah. You had a great conversation with him that I listened to. But this is Alex Garlick. He's a professor of policy at UVM, and he specifically just wrote this book called Pre-Existing Conditions about really the influence of lobbying in healthcare policy. I actually think it came out the same day that Steve Loeffler was officially became CEO of the hospital network. So kind of a nice correlation there.
Yeah.
But he opens this book with this great anecdote of working as a congressional staffer in Joe Kennedy's office. And he watches Nancy Pelosi take off her shoes on the Capitol Hill lawn and like literally jump for joy when the effort to repeal and replace Obamacare failed. And so he starts with this big national picture of healthcare, but really he ends up narrowing down and giving all these really rich examples of state by state policies and efforts to influence policy at a local level. And he really talks about the influence that lobbyists have in governments where we may not really be thinking or looking for these big picture things like repeal and replace. Obamacare is such a famous one, but
oh, yeah.
He really argues that a lot of these kind of health care reforms or more so these attempts to reform healthcare that get stymied are happening in state governments.
Yeah, you've seen this before, Kevin, too, under the Golden Dome in Montpelier,
sure.
Right?
For sure. And one of the fascinating things that I liked about the reporting on his book was that he appears to be pointing out that the more complex the subject is, the more likely that lobbyists have a tremendous amount of influence on it.
Yeah.
And the way he explains that, I think very well, is that, look, lawmakers are busy. They are regular folks often and especially in the state of Vermont, they're part-time legislators who are low, they're not paid very well, they don't have any staff, and they have sometimes struggled to keep up with the complexity of some of the legislation that's before them, and lobbyists always position themselves as the person who can help. Like, oh, here's a little bit of information for you, Senator, about how this complicated issue affects Vermonters. It may or may not come with an agenda, and so I really like the fact that the professor pointed out that the more complicated issue, the more influence lobbyists have, because I'm someone who likes to try to write about the things that are going on in Montpelier that are complicated, that need a little bit more insight into what's really happening, and so, there's a lot of lobbyists crawling around Montpelier on a regular basis, and it bears repeating that they have a tremendous influence on policy, and now we know the cost of some of the underlying policies.
And I'm really glad you spoke with Alex Garlick. I feel like that book sounds fascinating. So for anyone who didn't read his book, read the article that Olivia wrote on that in VT Digger, because it's really interesting, and it'll give you some perspective on just how complex these issues are. Howard Weiss-Tisman, I want to bring you back into the conversation, because this feels like a blast from the past to me. The Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Plant, at one point, this was the topic in Vermont, the dismantling of it, the decommissioning of it, et cetera. This is back in the news now because there's a Texas company that is eyeing the former site. What is going on there? What do they want to do with it?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you put it that way, because one reason why we're going to start hearing more about it is the decommissioning process it's not quite winding down. It's a year or two out. Remember, the company Northstar purchased the whole property, and they're a kind of commercial demolition company. So they've been tearing it all down, getting rid of the low-level radioactive waste, and they're about a year or two out from that. And so the big question has always been, what is the next thing that's going to happen on the site? They have the electric grid infrastructure there. The company updated the rail system there. So it's a really important piece of property. And I think like in the next year or two, we're going to be hearing a lot about it. So this company, Power Transitions, is a Texas-based company, and that's what they do. They go to old electric generating facilities and either turn them into sustainable solar fields or figure out other ways to hook them up to the grid. So this idea they've been floating in Vernon is to build a really large battery storage facility, which has some controversy added to it. These are not the smaller. Green Mountain Power has been putting up some battery storage, 2 to 5 megawatt kind of things around the state. We've heard a lot about this, but this is much bigger. This is like 15 or 20 megawatts, very large. They can catch fire. They're very hard to put the fire out. And when these lithium batteries, if they catch fire, they give out terrible gases. Some might question the wisdom of putting a facility that could catch fire near high-level radioactive waste, which is being stored in Vernon. So, yeah, it's a fascinating subject. This company had a couple of meetings with the Vernon Planning Commission. And when I called Kerrick Johnson, the commissioner of public service, I said, do you know anything about this? And he said, yeah, I actually have a meeting with them next month. So they're going to come to Vermont and talk about their project. And we're probably going to hear more about it over the next year or two as that site gets ready for redevelopment. There are probably going to be a lot of ideas floated. Again, this is a couple of years out, at least two, probably more, between the permitting and the building of whatever ends up there. But there will be a lot of interest in that property for sure.
Yeah, and I would imagine that meeting you're talking about is going to be have a lot of focus on those safety concerns, because as you were describing that, that immediately got me a little bit nervous. Again, I'm not an expert on these things, but I think a lot of people might feel the same way. Another story you've been working on, Howard, has to do with the Hyde Park Electric Department, and they have found themselves in some pretty hot water. Are they out of money? What is going on there?
They are out of money. Yes, they are. I've been told that the people, the customers, they have about 1,400 customers in Johnson and Hyde Park. There's no threat right now. They're going to lose their electricity, but they made a bunch of really bad decisions. As far as anyone can tell right now, there was no malfeasance. Nobody stole money. It just sounds like this is a very small electric utility. We have a lot of these in Vermont, 17 small electric companies, and a lot of them were built when, you know, they were bringing electricity to rural Vermont. So it made sense for a small town to have its own utility, but the whole business is just getting so much more complicated now. We know that climate change is bringing more intense storms. It's more expensive to keep the lines up. So they made some bad decisions. They took some money from their ratepayers that paid into the Efficiency Vermont and used that to pay some of their bills, which might be illegal. They owe money to GMP and Velco. So it's not a good situation. Right now, the Department of Public Service is trying to unravel the whole thing, find out where the money is, how much is owed, what is owed. What's probably going to come out of this is that ratepayers for Hyde Park Electric are going to probably see their rates go up to cover part of it. But we're at the beginning of this, kind of untangling it and trying to figure out just where all the money is and how bad it is.
It sounded a little bit familiar, Kevin McCallum, in Burlington situation there.
It does. Burlington Electric Department is nowhere near as bad off as that utility, but Burlington Electric Department is facing a management audit run by the PUC after concerns have been raised about some mistakes that they've made with ratepayer money and a complicated situation involving renewable energy credits that caused them to lose more than $1 million. And so I think it shows that the PUC is much more, and the Department of Public Service is much more willing than they have been in the past to publicly point out problems with utilities, because rates are going up, and utility rates across the state are going up, and so I think they feel the need to be a little tougher.
Okay. Olivia Giger, very quickly, you wrote a really fascinating article about a woman in New Hampshire who her daughter wanted to have some affirming care, can't get it, has to come to Vermont to do that.
Yeah, I think the upshot of what I want to stress about that is that care for young trans people in Vermont is protected right now. And it remains accessible.
For now.
For now. Of course, we're seeing our neighbors in New Hampshire. That is not the case. They passed two really restrictive bills this past summer that essentially banned access to any type of gender-affirming care for anyone under the age of 19 who isn't already receiving that care. So a lot of the providers, that will take place, that will start in 2026, but a lot of the providers here in Vermont are like really preparing themselves for the response to that here in Vermont, and not just from New Hampshire, but Connecticut is restricting care, and we're seeing just the impact.
And it's a very powerful story. You had a very personal story that you can read about in VT Digger. Now, before we go, we need to make a correction to a story that we discussed last week involving the resignation of Northfield's police chief, Pierre Gomez. In that discussion, a reporter stated that former Northfield police chief John Helfand had asked a question about the purchase of hoodies during an October 14th select board meeting, though that question was posed by Northfield select board member John Stevens. And I want to quickly mention that if you happen to be in Wardsboro tomorrow, go to the Gilfeather Turnip Festival, because our own Howard Weiss-Tisman is going to be one of the judges of that Turnip Festival there, along with Becca Ballant, I believe, Howard. It's a big responsibility.
Right.
Pick the right turnip,
please. I'm looking
forward
to it.
I think you'll do a great job. Thanks to our panel today, Kevin McCallum from 7 Days, Olivia Giger from VT Digger, and joining us remotely, Howard Weiss-Tisman from Vermont Public. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. Thank you so much for watching. I hope you'll tune in next week as well for Vermont This Week. In the meantime, hope you have a great week. Thank you, everybody.